Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, March 11th, 2006. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. As Lyndon LaRouche had warned in the recent EIR seminar in Berlin, this last week was characterized by developments which increased both the danger of the world strategic situation and also increased the volatility of the bankrupt global financial system. Of course, in addition to issuing this warning, Mr. LaRouche also presented solutions to these crises. On today's show, we will hear from Helga Zepp LaRouche, who will bring some much-needed clarity to these rapidly unfolding events and offer calm guidance and direction for what must be done to pull our world back from the brink of an all-out religious war and financial disintegration. In addition to Helga, who's joining us from Germany today, and I understand from her it's very cold there, so we'll help to warm up the airwaves here, we're going to have a panel of LIM members, Megan Beats from Boston, Steve Jeffrey from Detroit, and Patricia Prokop, who's a LaRouche Youth Movement member from Europe, who's presently in warm Los Angeles. So Helga, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. In comments over the last couple of days, Lyndon LaRouche has issued a call for calm in the face of what's an obvious push from Dick Cheney for an escalation against Iran. The media is filled with reports of impending actions by the UN Security Council and grunts and growls from Bolton against Iran. The media has also said the Russian initiative for a diplomatic settlement was a failure. What's the real story, as you know it, on this present situation with Iran?
Well, I think it's very important to differentiate between what is actually happening and an enormous amount of propaganda trying to hype the situation up. What actually happened is that the matter of Iran is still in the International Atomic Energy Agency domain. What El-Baradei did when he delivered the report, basically he informed the UN Security Council, but he did not defer the matter, which is a big difference. The Anglo-American media in particular, and you know also some other neocon media, have portrayed this as if the matter would already been transferred to the UN Security Council and therefore sanctions and the whole escalation would be inevitable. This is not the case, and the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov actually came out and said this is a very stupid game with words. This is still completely in the process of negotiation. The Russian proposal to have the Iranian enrichment done on Russian territory is still being talked about and negotiated, and it's not rejected by Iran. So there is a big difference between an actual situation and a very, very desperate effort by certain forces to create a public perception as if the matter would be out of control already. And that is definitely not the case. And I think it's very important, especially for people inside the United States, that they know that, you know, both the Russians and the Chinese and also forces in Germany, they're still completely working on a diplomatic settlement of this question.
Well, this impatience with diplomacy is very reminiscent of what was the lead up to the war against Iraq.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, here you have media, TV shows, news programs, all saying, oh my God, this is exactly a deja vu. This is exactly the kind of talk which happened before the Iraq war, where all of a sudden we were confronted with so-called evidence about Saddam Hussein's connection to Bin Laden, to Al-Qaeda, to weapons of mass destruction, to a 45-minute threat to every place around the globe. And look what happened. Nothing of that has remained. Instead, you have a complete disaster. You have the worst strategic disaster in American foreign policy with the Iraq war, far beyond the Vietnam war. And people are saying deja vu. The talk is exactly like on the eve of the Iraq war, but we should learn the lesson from the lies which led to the Iraq war and not repeat those and be lured into a war which would be much, 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 much worse than Iraq.
Well, it seems as though the marching orders to some extent came out of George Shultz and the Committee on Present Danger 3 back in January when they pretty much released the orders, we have to go to war against Iran. Why are they pushing for war, and what's the role of the British in this?
Well, the real reason has, and Lynn has pointed to this at two extremely important meetings we had just in Berlin, strategic seminars on the question of the Iran crisis, which was attended by many important people from Germany and also diplomats from other countries. Lynn pointed out repeatedly to the fact this has really very little to do with Iran. Sure, there is a internal Iranian complication, you know, represented by the forces which are in power in Iran right now. But other than that, it has almost nothing to do with Iran as such, because even the U.S. intelligence estimate, which was published last August, very clearly said that Iran is 10 years away from having access to nuclear weapons. So why the rush? You know, why is this all of a sudden such an urgent question? It has nothing to do with that. It has much more to do with the fact that the international financial system is in the really absolute final phase of its disintegration. And the forces who are pushing the policy of permanent warfare, of which the Afghanistan war was the first phase, then Iraq, now supposedly Iran, and as the former CIA chief Woolsey had said immediately after the September 11th, this now is supposed to be a war against terrorism of 100 years. Now, the real reason behind that is that the real word for globalization is a global empire, and that certain financial forces who realize that their entire system is about to blow out want to go to a strategy of permanent warfare to consolidate a global empire and eliminate any vestige of sovereign nation states, let it be Iran, let it be other countries, and just subdue the world under a bad imitation of the Roman Empire and really eliminate any independent force. Now, obviously, this will not function, and we are looking at a potential abyss, you know, because a war against Iran would be, you know, quite something different than the war against Iraq. It would be the starting point of a global asymmetric warfare, which would plunge the world into a dark age, because, you know, if you want, I can go through the details how this would look like, but, you know, it would not be pretty.
You're listening to Helga Zepp LaRouche, who is the founder of the influential Schiller Institute and the chairwoman of the BUSO, which is becoming a leading political party in Germany. This is the LaRouche Show, and we can take your questions by email. Send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. It's radio@larouchepub.com. Now, Helga, as part of your function in the Schiller Institute, you've been very outspoken on the idea of a dialogue of cultures as opposed to a clash of civilizations. But it does appear that this drive from the neocons is leading precisely into a kind of religious warfare that we haven't seen for close to four centuries. How far has this gone, and what kind of steps can be taken to pull back from this?
Well, you mentioned earlier the role of the British, and I think this is very important, because I have made recently repeatedly the point that if you look at day-to-day politics as you see it in the news or read it in the paper, people always take sense perception as reality. But when you go back in history and you look at, for example, the pre-history before the Iraq War, or even more in depth, the prehistory before World War One, you can actually see that, you know, in the case of the prehistory of World War One, you have to understand the 20 years before World War I, how the British Empire manipulated the Triple Entente, the Russo-Japanese War, the Balkan Wars of 1912, and preparing the entire chessboard. And then the shooting of Sarajevo was only the trigger for something which was prepared over a long period of time and which had essentially geopolitical reasons, because, you know, when the Eurasian land bridge was built at the end of the 19th century with the Trans-Siberian Railroad and the railroad from Berlin to Baghdad, the British geopoliticians feared that their control of the sea trade would be threatened. And then they started to manipulate the different chess figures on the board. Now, if you have that more complex view of history in mind, and then you apply that to the present crisis, you get an approximation of what actually happened. Because right now, the what we call the synarchist financial interests, which is the leading financial interests which have controlled, you know, the world financial system since the emergence of the British Empire in 1763, how they have basically reacted in the recent period to the threat to their system. And then you can actually see that the entire build-up of the clash of civilization goes back to the Bernhard Lewis plan, to the Bernhard Lewis conception of the arc of crisis in the entire region from Northern Africa into, you know, East Asia, and, you know, the whole Sykes-Picot Treaty, how the different imperialisms of Europe have divided that area as a playground with the Sykes-Picot Treaty of 1916, and how what is happening right now is a replay. For example, if you take the issue of the cartoons against the, you know, Prophet showing him as a terrorist, which was supposedly the kickoff of the violent demonstrations against European embassies in the Middle East and so forth. Now, we looked into this particular question of these cartoons. Were these innocent cartoons expressing the freedom of press? No, they were not, because the paper which published these cartoons first, which was the Jutland Posten, consulted 22 former Danish ambassadors who had served in Arab countries if that was a wise thing to do, and they all said, no, don't do it, it's a provocation, because you have a completely different time, you know, universe, because the, you know, Muslim world did not go through the Enlightenment, they did not go through certain other evolutionary steps Europe went through, so don't do it. Now, then we looked at a think tank, which is associated with that Danish paper, Jutland Posten, called CEPOS, and who sits in the board of that think tank? Nobody else than George Shultz, the mentor of the neocons in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I could go on for many details of this, but the picture is much more complicated than what meets the eye.
Well, Helga, this is an important point, because you mentioned this point of really knowing history. For most people who are the younger listeners on the show today, the idea of universal history has been destroyed as a conception. The idea that the British control anything, you look at Prince Philip and the royal family, and England looks like a broken-down country with toy soldiers, and this idea that there's some longer-term battle throughout the whole of the 20th century, and this goes back into the 19th century, and as your husband has pointed out, it goes back to 1763 and the founding of the British East India Company. How would you recommend that someone begin to get a grasp of the what you call the complication of real history?
Well, first of all, you have to start somewhere, you know, with a crucial equivalent of a universal principle, because you have to have some. You know, because you don't want to read a zillion history books which were written by people who had only one interest, namely to confuse history. You know, don't read professors and their footnotes and their footnotes on footnotes, because most of these books are written by the victorious forces of history, and many times these were oligarchs, and they have no interest to portray history as it is. So what the humanist tradition in Europe always said is go back to the sources, read the original. Don't read secondary books, or, you know, you can read them, but only after you have informed yourself about the crucial ideas in history. So start with the American Revolution. That's a very good starting point, and find out what was the watershed in modern history which the American Revolution represented, namely the idea that for the first time in history, in actual form, you had a constitution which guaranteed the inalienable right of all people, and the fact that the government is only legitimate if it is devoted to the common good, not only of the present but of all future generations, and if such a government is absolute sovereign. Now, this, from the standpoint of the oligarchy, was an absolute terrible challenge. And you cannot understand the present history and the role of the British Empire in the present Iran conflict if you don't understand why the emergence of the American Revolution, the American Declaration of Independence, the American Constitution was a real watershed. And in a certain sense, the battle is still today, you know, that will there be governments who devote their raison d'être, their reason of being, to the common good of the people, or does the world belong to the, you know, privileges of a few oligarchs on top? And, you know, I think if you go first with these fundamental conceptions, and then you can, you know, basically read your way back in the past and ahead in the future, but go with the principles established also by Friedrich Schiller in his piece on universal history, that you have to look at what is working in the present and then trace it back to its origins and then come back to the actual politics today. So in a certain sense, you know, it's like history in that sense is very much a science, even if sometimes it's more difficult to unearth the traces.
It's also living, as opposed to those people who teach it, who would convince you that history is dead, it's about the past, so you don't have to go there.
Yeah, right. Now, well, we found out a lot about history by trying to change it.
That's
know?
Right. Now, before we go to the LIM panel, I have one additional question for you, and it's on the same issue of history. There have been a couple of very interesting statements released by Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov in the last days that Lyndon LaRouche has pointed to as very significant. What is it that he has been saying, and what are the implications of this for the Russian intervention on the Iran situation?
Well, there was, for a certain period of time, a certain unclarity, you know, what would be the policy of Russia? Would they be somehow co-opted in the special relationship between George W. Bush and Putin? I mean, there was a certain period in which the media tried to portray a very special relationship among them, implying a U.S. neocon-Russia deal, or would Russia have some other policy towards Eurasia or what? Now, what the Lavrov series of articles and interviews reflects is very clearly an echo of an understanding of the Russian elite, of the writings of Lynn, of my husband. I don't know if Mr. Lavrov read those directly or if that was a more complex process, but essentially what you see in the arguments which Lavrov made, most interestingly a reference to Churchill's Fulton speech, and the fact that Russia had itself a period where it was, for ideological reasons, lured into, you know, ideas of world domination and similar things. The fact that Lavrov is bringing up these things now and basically warning, you know, essentially the neocons, even though he doesn't mention it directly as such, but the message is very clear, not to fall into these traps, means a reemergence of an independent Russia policy. And you actually can see a strengthening of the Russian position over the last, I would say, 1 or 2 years. So Russia is very importantly an independent player in the world picture right now. And I think the Russian proposal, which is backed, by the way, by China, by India, by other countries, not only to have enrichment for Iran, but to offer it to all countries from the so-called third world who want to have access to nuclear energy, because it is the sovereign right of every country in the world to have access to nuclear energy, is extremely important. So, basically, I think the Russian position right now is the only sane exit out of this mess, and people should really think about it and support it.
And I think the next issue of the Executive Intelligence Review will have excerpts of Lavrov's statements as well as analysis. And you can get the EIR through calling 888-347-3258. I'll be giving you that number again later on because I want to switch the direction a little bit to bring in the members of the LaRouche Youth Movement panel. Lyndon LaRouche issued a prolegomena for a party platform about 2 weeks ago titled Franklin Roosevelt's Legacy, which is a challenge to the Democratic Party and to honest Republicans and independents to change the nature of discussion in the United States away from the pragmatism and stench of littleness of party politics and actually take it to the realm of thought. And the LaRouche Youth Movement is working on the ideas in this document and will be circulating a million copies over the next couple of weeks. So with that as an introduction, let me bring in Megan Beetz from Boston. Megan, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Do you have some thoughts or questions for Helga?
I actually do have a question for Helga. It's on the issue of nuclear power and the whole nuclear non-proliferation treaty. Because I know that Lynn has said recently that the non-proliferation treaty is irrelevant at this point. And in trying to organize people, because I know, like, LaRouche has a completely different idea of the future than most people who are thinking, as you've described, in a sort of Hobbesian dog-eat-dog way. So my question becomes, how should we be getting the population to think about the nuclear issue in this time?
Well, I mean, first of all, something very interesting has happened, and that is that Bush went to India beginning of March, and therefore, you know, what I think Lynn has called totally opportunistic internal domestic reasons related to his campaign and the Republicans inside the United States, and obviously trying to split the Russia-India-China alliance. Bush has offered India very far-reaching cooperation in the field of nuclear energy. Now, this is really an incredible event. I mean, it's an earthquake. It's a historic, really big thing because, as you know, India did not sign the non-proliferation treaty. They went ahead with their own nuclear bomb, which a couple of years ago caused a tremendous freak out internationally. And here Bush goes to a country which he praises as the largest democracy, which, you know, it may be, but that's not the point. And he gives nuclear cooperation to a country which has on its own developed nuclear weapons and did not sign the NPT treaty. Now, obviously, the implication of that is that, you know, the same thing is denied to Iran when it is given to India, and that means simply the non-proliferation treaty is a dead letter. Because why should anybody respect a treaty, you know, when, you know, you just have to be quick enough with the bomb and then it's fine. So, you know, this is a very interesting complication of the situation. But the fundamental question is, without nuclear energy, and I think there the environmentalist paradigm, which has, you know, really poisoned the mind of many people, especially the boomer generation and, you know, the 68ers in Europe, on this question of nuclear energy. Because obviously we should have safe nuclear energy. We shouldn't have old, dangerous models, you know, which somewhere still exist are being used. But we do have absolutely safe inherently safe nuclear energy forms, for example, the high-temperature reactor, which was developed by Professor Schulten in Jülich, which was then implemented as a test reactor by China, starting to be built in 96. It's now completed and can be built in series, which the Chinese are planning to do. The South Africans are using it. Now, why is nuclear energy absolutely crucial? Because we have right now a world population of 6 billion people, or maybe a little bit more, and the level of population has something absolutely to do with the energy flux density. We cannot maintain 6 billion people with so-called alternative energy resources like solar and water and wind power and similar things. And therefore, every country has the sovereign right for the development of nuclear energy. I think this is very important, because this is a question around which we don't come, because this will be an absolute decision point if mankind is coming out of this crisis or not. So I think it is extremely important that people get over their irrational fears of nuclear energy, which was really the result of a tremendous campaign which was launched in the beginning of the 70s as a real oligarchical effort to reduce the population, because that's what it comes down to.
Helga, we have about a minute and a half before we take a short break. I'd like to just follow that up then by asking whether there's been any shift at all in Germany on nuclear energy, and in particular among the Greens, because some of the people in the United States who were anti-nuclear in the 70s have suddenly popped up saying, gee, maybe we do need nuclear energy. Anything like that in Germany?
Not in the Greens. I think their brain is pretty green. So I don't know if that will function again, but you have a tremendous debate in the CSU, the CDU, and I think Germany is probably going to be the last place where this brainwashing is going to be undone. But I think people are noticing the fact that there is a worldwide renaissance on nuclear energy. I think China is planning to build 40 new plants, Russia also 40, India similar numbers. So I think that eventually people will start to have a different attitude on this.
Aren't some of the German firms getting the contracts in China and India?
Yeah, sure. A lot of this is the absurdity, because a lot of these things have been originally developed in Germany, like the high-temperature reactor, like the Maglev train. That's not nuclear energy, but you know, a lot of technologies have been developed in Germany, and because of this green ideology, they have not been implemented in Germany, and Germany is now at a point of complete economic collapse, partly because of that.
Okay, well, we're going to go to a short break. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're live every Saturday on the Internet at larouchepub.com. You can hear us from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and if you miss the show live, you can find it archived on the LaRouche Pub website. If you wish to pick up a copy or get a copy, multiple copies of this new Prolegomena for a Party platform, in other words, a platform, the ideas behind the platform, which is what Lyndon LaRouche has written, you can call us and we'll send it out to you at 888-347-3258. That's 888-347-3258. And that's a free call for you. But it should be obvious that to put out a million of these pamphlets, we're going to need a lot of support. And the LaRouche PAC is essentially taking on the responsibility for not just changing the Democratic Party in Washington, but in the cities and county and rural areas of this country. So we're going to need funds for that, and you can also call that same number, and when you order your pamphlets, you can make a generous contribution, not more than $5,000. That's all you're allowed to send under the existing FEC laws. But call us at 888 347-3258 and tell them you heard about it on the LaRouche Show. So we are now back with Helga Zepp-LaRouche, who's joining us from Germany. And I'm going to go to the next member of our LaRouche Youth Movement panel, Patricia Prokop, who is in Los Angeles today. Patricia, how are you?
I'm well.
Do you have a question or a comment for Helga?
Yes, I have a question. Helga, I would like to go back to the Lavrov statements, because a lot of us here in the LA office have been very intrigued by his recent articles and how this clearly reflects the influence of Lin in his writings. And so I wanted to know if you could say something more on how what is going on in Russia. You know, why there's such a response from Russia?
Well, you know, in a certain sense, this is not so surprising because, you know, we have been in Russia many times. And, you know, Lin is a famous person in Russia. As a matter of fact, he's regarded as a legendary figure because I have to just go back a little bit. When President Reagan announced the SDI on the 23rd of March in 1983, you had a flurry of articles in the Russian media, in Izvestia, Red Star, and so forth, all blaming Lin, Mr. LaRouche, as the author of the SDI, calling him the enemy number one of the Soviet Union, and so forth. Now, while it would detonate the format of this show to go into the whole question, but you know, the proposal by Lin would have saved the Soviet Union if it would have been accepted, because Lin at that point proposed basically to end the two systems of NATO and the Warsaw Pact, and to replace it with a completely new world order called mutual assured survival instead of mutual assured destruction. In any case, this should, you know, be subject of a whole show in itself because it's a very complicated issue. But in any case, Lin was very known among the Russian scientists, the military-industrial complex at that time. And when Lin prognosed in 1983 that if the Soviet Union would not adopt his proposals for a change of the global system, the Soviet Union would disintegrate in 5 years. Now, as everybody knows, the Soviet Union did disintegrate. It did not take 5 years, it took 6 years, but Lin was the only person even having any perception of why this would happen and who was able to prognose what actually did happen. So when the Soviet Union finally then disintegrated between 89 and 91, a lot of these scientists took the scientific ideas of Lin very serious. They studied and they said, how comes that this man was able to make such a prognosis? And a group, hundreds of Russian scientists, started actually to really study Lin's ideas very, very seriously. So I think this is the big difference. I have not seen anywhere outside of Russia such a real serious intellectual preoccupation with Lin's writings, not in the United States, not in any European country or most other parts of the world. And therefore, it does not surprise me one bit that, you know, there would be such a resonance from Lin's ideas.
Okay, we're going to go to a question from the email, and I'd like to encourage people, if you have questions for Helga or for the Lin panel, you can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. The question is from Paula Mae Larson, and she asks, Helga, does the neglect of Milosevic in his jail cell, and if people don't know this, Milosevic was found dead in his jail cell yesterday, does this indicate any future policy for the UN Ethics Committee?
Well, I mean, obviously, there are wild speculations flying around that he was killed, which is too early to make any judgment about. But obviously, you know, he did have a heart condition. His trial was about to start. And I think it does require an investigation just for the simple reason that the situation in the Balkans is remaining very volatile. Essentially, you know, you have the Kosovo situation, you have the not so calm situation around Bosnia, and I think it does require definitely an investigation because the Balkans does remain one of the places which could easily blow up in a general destabilization, all the more because there was absolutely no economic development since the wars ended.
So we seem to make the same mistake over and over. I remember that you put out a very clear call after the war ended in Kosovo that there had to be immediately economic aid, and that still has not taken place.
Yes.
All right, well, let's go to our third member of the LIM panel, Steve Jeffrey, who's in Detroit in the middle of the fight over the auto sector and LaRouche's ideas on retooling. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead, Steve. You have a question?
Yeah, for sure. And it comes from some of the work trying to figure out what exactly the direction LIM is setting for the organizing in this coming period from this platform. And it's, I mean, it's very central, the discussion of nuclear energy, and you have two distinctly opposite directions. One, like a huge portion of this platform is actually the discussion of, you know, the threat from those who would choose to control nuclear technology for weaponry, war, and, you know, and terror of the worst kind, you know. And so my question is, it's sort of how do we orient a type of science driver that would, if we have such a problem with many nations around the world being afraid or scared of nuclear technology, what do we do to carry these people up in a storm of development and renaissance?
Well, I think the only realistic proposal on the table, which is workable, is, as I said, the Russian proposal. Because, you know, you do have the difficulty that, you know, while in theory, not only does every country have the right for nuclear energy, but also the right for nuclear weapons. Why should anybody decide that certain countries have right to possess nuclear weapons and others not? Then you have a whole category of countries which have nuclear weapons. Everybody knows it, but nobody talks about it, like Israel, Pakistan, and probably some others as well. And all of a sudden, other countries are rogue states and are failed states, and they are not supposed to have the right for nuclear weapons. How do you get rationality into this? Now, I'm not a friend of nuclear weapons because I think that this is a sword of Damocles which is hanging over the fate of mankind, because obviously if you enter nuclear war, then that's it. And, you know, I think if people would know how potentially close we are to that, I think most people wouldn't sleep so well, because if what Cheney's orders supposedly, according to this American military person who published this already in July, I think his name was Philip Giraldi, mm-hmm. That if there is any new terrorist attack on an American city, supposedly Cheney has given the order for an immediate military strike from Ofuts, Nebraska, on Iran, including the use of mini-nukes, and then, you know, that would obviously trigger a counterstrike by Iran. Israel would get involved. You would have attacks on American soldiers in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Turkey. So in no time, we would be in a absolutely potentially out-of-control global asymmetric warfare. So I'm not in favor of nuclear weapons. But the question is, you know, how do we create a world in which people don't want nuclear weapons anymore? And therefore, I think for an intermediate period, this Russian proposal, which says, okay, Russia, together with some other countries, for example, China and possibly India, are providing every country in the world with the right to have full access to nuclear, peaceful nuclear energy by enriching their uranium in Russian territory. And that way, you know, helping these countries to make the jump to have access to nuclear energy without, you know, basically opening the door to their access to nuclear weapons. So I think that that is definitely something which should be picked up right away. But then I think we need a complete rethinking. We need to really go into the direction of a crash program in many areas. The question of fusion energy is the most obvious one, because that would redefine the access to raw materials. But we need crash programs and the science driver approach to many, many, many areas of the economy. Just take the threat of the bird flu, which, you know, I have looked into in recent weeks, because it's now spreading in Europe, in many countries. And once that virus mutates to become infectious from human beings to human beings, the danger of a new pandemic like we had it in 1918, where between 20 and 50 million people were killed, that threat would immediately be there and threatening a much larger section of mankind today. So how do you go about such a threat? You go with it. I proposed for some years now a biological defense initiative modeled on the SDI by basically saying we need to crack the question of what is life in a much more fundamental way than just trying to cure diseases. We have to approach it from the standpoint of the Russian scientist Vladimir Vernadsky, the question of what is the relationship between the biosphere, the noosphere, how can we define the question of, you know, defending life in a preventive, preemptive form. So that could be another aspect to such a science driver. I think we have to just completely go away from, you know, thinking about the economy from the standpoint of saving, of austerity, of cost-cutting, of all the different elements which are belonging to the present collapsing world financial system, and go back to the ideas of physical economy and the question of the American system as it was developed by Alexander Hamilton, and the, you know, question that the state, the government has the right to create credit in order to facilitate such investments in the future of the economy and the people.
You're listening to Helga Zepp-LaRouche. This is the LaRouche Show, March 11th, 2006. I'm going to get back to the Lynn panel in a moment, but I have a question for you, Helga, from one of Lynn's friends in the Democratic Party, who's an older Democrat, who said to me yesterday to ask you, how do you and Lynn remain so optimistic about the possibilities for change in the U.S. population when they voted for such idiots and liars as Bush and Cheney and the other neocons? As you can tell, there's a little despair in his question.
Yeah, well, I mean, we are asked many times, you know, about how can we even say something positive about the United States, because the image of the United States around the world has never been so down, so badly. I mean, you have no idea. You talk to the average person, you know, in the bakery or some other place, and they explode. And we have a very hard time to tell people that there is a huge difference between the neocons and the real America as it is represented by the founding fathers, by Lincoln, by, you know, FDR, by Martin Luther King, and by the LaRouche movement today. So I know fully well what this problem is. But, you know, I think that the question of optimism on the one side comes from, you have to have a very clear idea how you want the world to look like. And once you have a positive conception of what you want, you know, America, Europe, Germany, the rest of the world, how it should be, you know, from the standpoint of the potential of what human beings really are, I have a very positive vision. And I'm working to implement that vision. And therefore, when things go badly, I don't get discouraged. I just get more energetic, because then the task is obviously much more bigger, because the discrepancy is bigger. Once you love mankind, then, you know, or you love your country, or you love your, you know, tradition, or in terms of great things which have been contributed by people belonging to your country, you don't get discouraged. Your energy, that you cannot take it, that all your fellow citizens are being, you know, on a much lesser level of human fulfillment, mm-hmm. it gives you energy. And then also the fact that once you understand that this system is really not working and it's coming to an end, and only if it is coming to an end is there going to be room for a new system. So therefore, when I hear, okay, now the yen carry trade is no longer functioning, well, on the one side, this is obviously about a very big danger, because if the Japanese are no longer pursuing their zero interest rate policy, then, you know, that will have an immediate effect on the interest rate policy internationally, and it eventually will pop the U.S. housing market. So most people say, oh, my God, the U.S. housing market is going to pop, and they say this is terrible. And actually, it is terrible, but it's not terrible when you know this is going to be inevitably so anyway. So in a certain sense, you know, it's better if these things become clear, because then it's also becoming apparent that we have been right, that especially Lynn has been right for, you know, decades, and that, you know, more and more people say, okay, maybe this guy LaRouche has a solution, we better look at it. So the optimism comes from a clear determination of knowing what to do, from a tenacity in pursuing your task, and from having a beautiful vision of where we should go. So therefore, you know, we are most of the time extremely, you know, happy, despite the fact that the world is not so good.
Well, I like the idea of the housing bubble popping, because we can't afford rents anymore in the Los Angeles area. All right, we have probably about 13 minutes left. I want to get back to the youth panelists. Megan, do you have something else?
Yeah, I do. Helga, I have a question about what's going on in Germany. And I know that last year when Chancellor Schroeder called for new elections, you campaigned and many members of the youth movement in Germany campaigned, and we were having a lot of fun targeting the neocon policies of Angela Merkel. So my question is, one, what's up with the Merkel government? Is it really as bad as we were saying? And connected to that, what role is the LaRouche youth movement continuing to play now in Germany?
Well, I think we had a tremendous success in knocking out the worst Merkel option in this election campaign, because Merkel at that time was, you know, basically teamed up with a guy called Kirchhoff, who was a real neocon who wanted to destroy the social system, according to his own words, with a sledgehammer. So I think we knocked down the option of a CDU-liberal coalition, and instead there was a grand coalition, which is now a very, very weak but middle-of-the-road combination. There's a tremendous vacuum. I think Merkel is adapting to the new coalition of forces. She's not doing anything really. She has not done any original policies. We have a growing unemployment. The unemployment is still 9 to 10 million in Germany. The European Monetary Union is definitely not going to last. You know, people who poo-pooed my proposal to return to the D-Mark in this election campaign, behind the scenes, they are telling us now, well, it's a question of time. This thing is not working. I'll just give you one example. You have in all the European countries who have completely different levels of economic development, you have one euro, one currency. And, for example, in Spain, you have an inflation rate of 6.5%, and I think in Germany something like 2.5%, but we have one euro. So people can take credits in Spain where you have 6.5% inflation and, you know, take credit at a rate which does not take this into account, and all what that contributes to, as well as many other imbalances, is to bankrupt Germany at a rate which is breathtaking. Germany right now is collapsing, and when Germany collapses, the euro will blow out of the window as well. So the Merkel government is doing nothing, and therefore the LaRouche Youth Movement is really filling a tremendous vacuum. We had a fantastic campaign for the mayor of Leipzig, where we had Carsten Werner, who did a magnificent job with the youth movement, you know, turning Leipzig upside down with chorus work, singing Bach, Jesu meine Freude, and many other beautiful songs. By the way, we had a new song where, you know, I wrote a little different text for the Battle Cry of Freedom, which, you know, I changed it, the Union Forever, into Leipzig, my Leipzig, and people were really very, you can listen to it to the in the Büso webpage, the German song. Anyway, so the LIMD is now planning to expand these election campaigns. We will have an upcoming Berlin campaign for the mayor of Berlin. And, you know, basically the youth are in a very good spirit. I think that the idea that, you know, it is that generation which has to take responsibility for the future of Germany and Europe is people really have gotten that idea. So I'm very happy about this development.
I think you just actually exemplified what you said earlier about why you're optimistic, that you take a situation which looks pretty bad and you flank it and create new options.
Yeah, well, I love Germany. You know, Germany has a tremendous tradition. We have from Nikolaus of Kues, Kepler, Kästner, Lessing, Mendelssohn, Schiller, Beethoven, we have all these beautiful people, and out of their contribution, I'm optimistic that we will have in the new generation new such people.
Okay, well, Patricia, you have another question for Helga?
Yes, I do. Helga, could you comment on what is happening in France and why there seems to be a rather aggressive response to the Iranian nuclear program, and also how the LIMD there should organize, especially in the light of the presidential campaign of Jacques?
Well, unfortunately, with the election of Merkel in Germany, the previously good relationship between Germany and France has broken apart, and France, for the time being, seems to have sunken back to their old, more imperially oriented policy of the Sykes-Picot tradition. And, you know, I think that is the context in which Chirac made this very strange remark that if there would be a terrorist attack in France, then the force de frappe would be used against the regions out of which these terrorist attacks would be guided, which was a clear reference to Iran, implying that, you know, France would even go nuclear against such countries, which is totally, everybody was in complete shock about such a statement. Now, the problem is that the French economy is collapsing, and you have basically, you know, very nasty responses. You have Sarkozy, who is a neocon, totally. He's a friend of the neocons in Washington. Then you have the Villepin, who is, you know, making terrible austerity cuts. For example, he's now proposing to make a law in which youth can be kicked off in their teaching education, which lasts 5 years, in the first 2 years, without a reason, which basically means no protection whatsoever. So yesterday, the Sorbonne was occupied by students. People were already talking about a replay of 68. Mm. The police cleaned out the university by force, which, you know, normally towards universities, they never do that, or, well, that's a big thing at least. And, you know, the country is clearly disintegrating. Their export is collapsing. their import is being flooded by cheap labor products from outsourcing, you know, from globalization and so forth. So the country is really in trouble, and therefore the only option for France to rejoin any positive development is the presidential campaign of Jacques Cheminard, the collaborator of Lyndon LaRouche since many years in France. And they basically really want to set an alternative because, you know, France has a very positive tradition of collaboration with the United States in the time of the American Revolution. If you think about the collaboration of Lafayette, of the League of Armed Neutrality and this period, and that is the spirit in which people around Jacques' campaign, the LIM in France, but also the LIM in Germany and the BÜSO are working together to create a new Atlantic alliance in the tradition of Franklin D. Roosevelt to have a new Bretton Woods system and to have a new deal to bring, you know, not only the United States but also Europe out of this crisis.
Okay, we have about 4 minutes left. Steve, do you have another question?
Yeah, hopefully you can make this quick. My question is on Bach's stay in Leipzig, and just his character I find sort of funny because he doesn't really reveal his character so much in his letters, right? He seems very, very severe and professional. And I was wondering how much collaboration do you know he had in Leipzig, because that was such a center for development.
Well, I really don't know the biographical concrete situation of Bach at the time of his work, but you know, Leipzig in general is just such an unbelievable hotbed of total creativity from the period of before Leipzig. Because remember that the Thomana Corps existed already since, I think, I don't know exactly, many centuries ago.
I think it was from the 1200s, St. Thomas Chorus. Yeah,
because in the time of the 30 Years' War, it had shrunk to 3 chorus members. And there is one famous quote where it says, well, we are standing here and singing even if we're only 3. So that tradition lasted, you know, no matter what storms, and 30 Years' War was actually a 150 Years' War in totality. It lasted throughout this period, and you know, it really is a example of you know, what a long tradition really contributes in reproducing such geniuses again and again. So, you know, then if you think about that, Leipzig is not only Bach City, but it's also Leibniz City. And the way we did the election campaign, or one point which we emphasized in the election campaign, was, you know, that the special relationship between Leipzig and the United States is the fact that if you consider that it was Leibniz who coined this idea of the pursuit of happiness formulation, which is in the Declaration of Independence, and therefore shaped the image of man which comes out in this declaration, but that Leibniz also was the founder of physical economy, which for the first time was really implemented by Alexander Hamilton and, you know, the National Bank and the whole American system. And that therefore, you know, Bach City and Leibniz City and the question of reviving the American Revolution and the American system, not only inside the United States, but as a matter of principle, in the future community of principle of perfectly sovereign nation states in the tradition of John Quincy Adams. I mean, people really, you know, started to connect with that. So, you know, while I don't know the exact circumstances of Bach, I think you need just to come to Germany, learn German, go into the libraries, dig in, do the research, and have fun.
Well, and of course, Helga, Leipzig is the sister city of Houston, Texas.
Yes, yes, and we were very happy about the greetings which Carsten Werner got.
Yes. Okay, well, we're just about out of time. Helga, thank you so much. I think you did bring some clarity and some calm. I think we need some calm now so the Americans can shut off their televisions and actually start thinking. To do that, we've got to get this platform out, 1 million copies in the next couple of weeks. Call us at 888-347-3258 and join us next Saturday. Thank you to the LIM panel, and thank you to all the listeners. Goodbye.
Bye.